Introduce our main speaker for tonight, Mickey C. from Downey.
Yeah. Settle down, Damien. Hi, everybody. My name is Mickey Cook. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here. Glad to be anywhere sober. I'd like to thank Larry for asking me to come out. And it's also an honor and a privilege. And, you know, I just got, if there's any tough guys here, I'm a crier, you know. I'm already choked up. I'm a dirtbag by nature, you know. I am wired for bad behavior still today. I was talking to somebody, I don't know what I was doing, but I said, I shouldn't be left I didn't get a ticket, by the way, and I'm feeling lucky. I'm an ADD adult, obviously, but, you know, I am wired for bad behavior. I shouldn't be left unattended for very long. Period. I need Alcoholics Anonymous. I need it badly. I need it frequently. I need everything you got to offer, so I do everything you got to offer. Not out of virtue, because I'm just wired for bad behavior. My wife, Nancy, many of you have heard, she has short red hair. She's always goes, woo! She's nuts. But she says something that I just love. She says, her alcoholism demands treatment. My alcoholism demands treatment. I just can't go out. I'm just not equipped, you know. I don't want to make the newcomer think, oh, my God, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. You know, 20 years sober and he's still struggling. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I don't suffer from alcoholism. You know, I suffer from alcoholism, you know. And I'll tell you how my day. Oh, I wanted to thank Chris for his talk. I'm so amused. I'm a quantity thinker. I want you to know that. I'm not a quality thinker. I just think really, really fast. And I try to capture stuff and give it to you so maybe we can make sense. I also know that I'm here tonight for one reason. Not to save anybody. You know, my friend Larry Thomas, a good friend of mine, we talked about it one time. It's like rubbing Neosporin on some lepers. I come here tonight, and they feel better if you do that. But all I'm doing tonight is try to give you enough hope to get you home. You know, right? Enough hope to wake up tomorrow and do it one more time. Enough hope to get up in the morning and answer that call. You know, caller ID was the most hideous thing ever invented for an alcoholic sponsor. You know, I don't look anymore. I just answer my phone. Oh, he's an idiot. I'm not answering that, you know. But I'm glad to be here. I get captured by little things. I came in tonight and I noticed your birthday list. And it said Triple X Steve. My head said, well, I never met a porn star. That's going to be interesting. Yeah. That's just how my head goes, man. That's just how my head runs. And then I was listening to Chris, who I'm sure was uncomfortable sharing, and I tried to tell him, you know, it was just an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting. It's not Carnegie Hall. You know, I've never heard of them chopping up a speaker into little pieces and flushing him down the toilet instead of sending him home, you know. But when he was talking, I love the alcoholic perception. At least mine is always distorted. I always get a bad picture. But he talked about trying to control his drinking, and he said he did a pretty good job. Then he immediately started talking about seizures and DUIs and detoxes. I'm sorry, you failed miserably at controlling and enjoying your drinking, you know. I had a great day. I came down here last. I have 10 grandkids. I'm a grandpa. Yo, bro. I'm a grandpa, and I part of my story, and I'll probably get to that. I always say that I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for when I got here, I had the inability to care about another human being. I simply didn't care, you know. And you have given me a capacity to love, and you've given me the capacity to love greatly, and I always say that you taught me how to love just in time to meet my grandchildren. You know, anyway, so today I got down here last night. I got to watch my 4-year-old graduate from preschool. Caps and gowns, the whole schmear. I mean, it went on for an hour and a half. They did some little dance, and she smiled from ear to ear. And Papa, you know. But I was glad I can be there. I could have missed it. I was supposed to be drunk in a treehouse somewhere or on a roof of a school. You know, but today I got up this morning very early and I played golf with my son. My son is a Class A teaching professional. He teaches golf locally, and so he went out and schooled me on the golf course. And so I played 18 holes of golf with my son and my son-in-law. That's a great gift for free. It's kind of an unwritten law among PGA community. I went out to Salt Creek, didn't pay a dime. But then I went home and we had lunch, and they went to a baseball game, and I took a nap. None of my grandkids were playing on that team or I'd have gone. They wanted to go see my son, and my grandson has a broken arm. He can't play. I don't want to watch his team play. I want to watch him play. Anyway, so I took a nap, and I woke up, and when they came in, I was doing my breathing machine. I have, that's another issue. I got problems with my lungs. And he said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm not doing too well." He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "I've had about 4 hours alone, you know, just to think, you know." It starts small. I call it reverse pyramid thinking. It starts really small. You know, it starts with, you know, "I'm a little tired, you know. I'm really, really tired. I don't want to go to South Bay Speakers tonight. Jesus Christ, they've heard me 3 times. I mean, I'm putting people to sleep." Just get bigger and bigger and bigger. I'll give you a classic example of pyramid thinking in reverse. First time I heard it was a guy named David L. from South Carolina, a powerful speaker. I was a couple of years sober, and he was great. He talked about, he's standing in front of the mirror, he's in the shower, and he's singing. He's singing country western. He's singing Lee Greenwood. I don't know who Lee Greenwood is. He's a country western singer. And everybody sounds pretty good in the shower, right? I'm sure you've been captured. You hear yourself singing in the shower. You're going, "Wow, I didn't know I could sing that good." You can't. You know, anyway. So he's singing in the shower, and he's thinking he sounds like Lee Greenwood. And his next conscious thought is he's standing in front of the mirror, and he's shaving, and he's thinking, "Where am I going to get a tour bus?" That's how my head runs. It just goes off on me. About 10 years ago now, my wife is walking through the living room, and she went, early in the morning, she went, "I have a gift." I know precisely what she meant by that. You know, right? So I start doing the math. You know, I'm going over my calendar. What have I done? Did I not take out the trash? Did I leave the toilet seat up? Did I eat the last cookie? Did we run out of milk? Do we need more banana? You know, I'm doing the math, you know. It starts little, gets bigger, 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 bigger. So my next conscious thought, 5 minutes later, I'm in front of the mirror and I'm shaving, and my head says, "Well, you can't live with Glenn. I've already moved out. We're divorced." She hasn't said another word to me. She hasn't sighed again. But I know, like, I have that gift. With that kind of thinking, that's why I can't be left unattended. You know? And I know the difference now. One of the big... I've been married for 29 years to the same woman. And as part of my story, I tell you, I'm a multi-marrier. I've been married to the same woman for 29 years because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we never wanted to get divorced on the same day. But I also know... I've learned. I'm going to tell you, if you're new, right? Because if we'd have paralleled up, it would have been over. But it wasn't. But I know that one of the things. I'll tell you something. If you're new and you're struggling in your marriage in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to put it kind of clearly. Shut up. You know, you don't have to have an opinion about everything she says or does. You know, and when I know that when my wife comes to me and she says, "Work was so hard. I had such a bad day at work." She doesn't want me to fix that. She doesn't want me to say, "Would you like me to go burn down the restaurant?" You know. She just wants me to say, "Gee, I'm sorry you feel that way." Just learn how to communicate. I don't want to get off on some kind of pseudo-psychological babble like I know something. You know, I'll walk by tomorrow morning and she'll sigh and I'll do it again. But I'm a real alcoholic, and I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And the reason we talk about, at least the reason I talk about what it was like, is for the purpose of identification, so that maybe somebody out there can say, "I felt like that too," or "I did that too. I meant to do this and it wound up like that. You know, I meant to go out for a drink and I wound up in Tijuana." You know, I bet that happens a lot down here because it ain't that far. Jesus, damn near. I remember every time I drive down here, it says international border 19 yards, and I say, "Put it on cruise control. We can be there in 20 minutes." You know. But I'm an alcoholic. I'm a bad alcoholic. And I've told the story 1,000 times, and I hope to get the opportunity to tell it 1,000 times more. Go back to talk to my wife real quick. Sorry, I told you. It's going through really fast. I'm a quantity thinker, not a quality thinker. At this Canyon conference in Oklahoma that my wife and I spoke at a couple of weeks ago, one of the things they do there, some of the people with a little bit of time, the couples that go up there, they renew their vows. And that's not, they don't have a big ceremony. They just go into this chapel and they renew their vows with each other. So my wife came to me Saturday morning at breakfast and she said, "Several of the people here renew their vows. Would you like to renew your vows?" I'm not an idiot. You know, "Oh, yes, I would. You know, Can we do them in pencil this time? I'm just kidding. You know. But I'll tell you what happened because of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went into the chapel and we both cried. My wife's not a crier, but I'm a crier. And I apologized for a lot. I said, Nancy, I wish a lot of things had been different. Because I'm going to tell a little bit about my story. I had a relapse. We've been married for 29 years. I've been sober for 20. You know, so it wasn't always good. And I said, I would marry you again today, and I'd like to sign on for 29 years, 29 more years. I didn't tell her that I would be 94 and I knew my contract would expire. I didn't. Just because it goes through my head doesn't have to mean it comes out my mouth, you know. But she did the same thing, you know, and she cried, and it was a spiritual experience. It was a spiritual experience to tell the woman that apparently I'm going to die with, that I want to live with her for the rest of my life and mean it. And I sign every birthday card, Christmas card, Valentine's Day card. I always sign it with the acronym, I'm the luckiest guy in town. And I really believe that. Anyway, I used to drink a lot, unsuccessfully. The very first time I ever had anything to drink, I was dared to chug a pint of sloe gin. And bad idea. You already have an unusual relationship with alcohol if you've never had anything to drink and you're willing to chug a pint of sloe gin. You've learned some bad information, and I did, and I got really, really drunk and went into a blackout, and I woke up in the morning, and I had gone blind. And I think really, really fast. Oh, my God, I've gone blind. Oh, my God, figure of speech. I thought the blind drunk with a figure of speech. You really do go blind. Oh, my God. Well, what had happened is I had puked in my sleep, and the syrup and the slow gin had stuck my eyes shut. You know. So I was so relieved when I washed my face, you know. I've never drank slow gin again after that, I tell you what, right? You know that sensation, you know. Because once you heave something really, really heave, I'm talking projectile vomit, you know. Once you do that with something, you never drink it again. There's some cough syrups that remind me of that. I can't use those either. I can't eat those little Vienna sausages anymore either. Same reason. Or those little red hot candies. They will ugly up a couch, I want to tell you, you know. Anyway, but that's how I drank, you know. And the reason I drank like that, the reason I had that relationship with alcohol, because from the very first time I had a drink, I was drinking with desperation. I was predisposed for alcoholism long before I ever had a drink. I tell this story often, but to kind of characterize why I needed a drink. I'm in the third or fourth grade with Sister Wilhelmina. I used to call her Sister Mary Beat Me, you know. But my mother raised five children on state aid, right? My father left when I was 4 years old, and there wasn't a lot of money to go around, and she would pack lunches for us, and she'd pack me a peanut butter sandwich and a couple of Ritz crackers and give me a nickel for milk. And I started to figure out that I felt differently than you, and I couldn't risk you looking at me and confirming my suspicions that I wasn't enough. So I wouldn't break out my lunch because my perception was you all had a Subway sandwich and a bag of Doritos and a couple of Ding Dongs and a bottle of Dr. Pepper. That's what it looked like to me. And I couldn't take out what I thought was my inferior lunch and risk you looking at me with that jaundiced eye telling me I wasn't enough because I already knew that I didn't measure up. I already knew that. So I would just stuff them in my desk. I'd rather starve than look bad. I'd rather starve than quit drinking. I mean, I'd rather drink myself to death than look bad, too. So I stuff them in my desk, and after a little while, you know, I don't know anything about time and temperature violations. They start to stink a little bit, you know. I don't care. I'm 10 years old, you know. At 10 years old, you kind of like things that smell funky, you know, right? And Sister Mary Beat Me came around, and she found these lunches in my desk, and I realized in hindsight she handled it very poorly, and she pulled them out, and she looked at me, and she asked me for the first time that I can remember that question that I was going to be asked 1,000 times. She said, "Mickey, what's wrong with you?" In front of the whole class, you know, good Lord, handled it badly. And I gave the same answer I always gave. I said, I don't know. I should have said, "Sister, I need a martini," you know, right? Because when you're wired like that, and I'm just dancing with you, and so afraid of you, you know, I still can today. Left unattended. If I step away from Alcoholics Anonymous, you again become threatening. Life is just too hard. When I was in Oklahoma, They give you a host. They treat you like a prince. My host is a guy named Tim C. from Dallas, Texas, and they drive you around in a golf cart, and they bring you coffee in the morning, and they just treat you really, really good. But when he also introduces you at the Saturday night meeting, and he said, Mickey's never met anybody that wasn't his friend, and I didn't come here like that. I didn't come here like that. I was afraid of you and just dancing and trying to measure up just to be enough. You know, and I oftentimes think in Alcoholics Anonymous, we need to be treated special just to feel normal. We're very, very good to each other, and there's a reason for that. Because left to my own devices, I just want to grind myself down. So I'm not having any luck drinking. I'm stuffing lunches in my desk, and I needed a martini, and I don't know what I'm going to do. So a couple of weeks later, there was a parent-teacher conference, and my mother, who taught at that school, comes over, and Sister Wilhelmina, I'm going to stop calling her Sister Mary, beat me, God rest her soul. But Sister Wilhelmina says, I've got to have to keep Mickey back because he can't read. My mother laughed. She said, what do you mean he can't read? Your son can't read. She said, that's ridiculous. He reads the sports page cover to cover every morning before he goes to school. The thing was, I would never read for Sister Wilhelmina. I put her in that chair of resentment, bleachers of resentment. You know, it turns out I had a stadium of resentments, right? Just one of those, I just started to stack them up. People I couldn't have, people that did me wrong, you know. I didn't have a part in that until I did my inventory. I was a rotten kid. Around that same time, I'm 12 years old, and I'm already separating myself from God. We take this thing called first confession. I'm a Catholic. I'm not a recovering Catholic. I think that's an insult to good Catholics, you know, right? That process works very, very good for some people. My mother, till the day she died, was a devout Catholic. My sister's a Eucharistic minister. My brother was a priest. My sister was a nun. They love Catholicism. And when I say I was a recovering alcoholic, recovering Catholic, like they did something to me. But they didn't. But they had the sacrament of confession. And what it is, you go take a fifth step with a priest. You go in this little dark room and you tell him what you did. And I'd go in there and say, I stole a piece of gum from the J&T market. I stared at Donna Vayu's boobs. And I gave Sister Wilhelmina the finger behind her back, you know. And he'd say three Our Fathers, three Hail Marys, and three Glory Bees as a penance. You'd have to go to the altar and say your penance. But I also realized that he wasn't listening. Because I swear to God, the next time I could go there and say, well, I nuked the bank, you know. I started my sister on fire, and I chopped Father Dave Zanino's head off, you know, or something like that. And he'd say three Our Fathers, three Hail Marys, three Glory Bees. You know, and I would go to the altar, and the nuns would make you go to the altar and say your penance, and I did the Evelyn Woods speed praying prayer. Our Father, I don't give you any, God, as quickly as I could, because I didn't want people to know I was a sinner, because I'm worried about what you think of me. I'm acutely aware of what you think of me. I'm scared to death of what you think of me, because I got nothing. I got nothing to work with. I'm nothing on a downhill drag. So I used to go up to that altar, and I would pray to the Infant of Prague. The Infant of Prague was a little statue about this tall, and always dressed very ornately, and he had a globe in his hand. And I would talk to the little Infant of Prague, so I'm not going to church by myself, and I'd say, hello, it's me, Mickey, you know. And I said, I'm really scared out here. I knew there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know I needed a drink. I said, would you do me a favor, little baby Jesus? You know, hey, Talladega Nights stole that from me, because I used to call him little baby Jesus, and I said, could you talk to Mary and have Mary talk to Jesus and have Jesus talk to God? Because God forbid I talk directly to God, you know. It would be a lightning bolt, and I knew it, you know. And because I was just terrified. And then months after that, somebody broke into the church and they vandalized the church. And one of the things they did is they burnt the Infant of Prague. They started it on fire. And Father Dave Zanino, chop his head off, right? And dragged me into the sacristy with my mother, and he said, Mickey vandalized the church, and he burned the Infant of Prague, and I hadn't done it, you know. And my mother knew I hadn't done it because she knew when I was lying. I didn't know how she knew when I was lying, but I have children now. I know when they're lying. It was way easier with me to know if I was lying because I was lying all the time, you know. My son is 32 years old and a very good golfer. And I didn't see his ball. He hit a ball today, and I heard him going, shit. And I said, where'd it go? He said, I banged it right down the middle. I said, you're full of shit. No, you didn't. So he started to laugh. He goes, yes, I did. I said, no, you didn't. 32 years old, you're still lying to me, you know. But he was cracking up. It was a good exchange. So I'm 12 years old, and I'm not doing well, and I decided one day we're at church, and so I went out and decided I was going to steal cigarettes out of the cars. Everybody smoked. I didn't smoke, but I was practicing my stealing skills, you know. And I got caught, and I got handcuffed in the backseat of the Lakewood Sheriff Station police car, and I'm sitting in the backseat when my mother comes out of the school she taught out with my brother the priest, my sister the nun, my sister the hospital administrator, my other sister the doctor, and Mickey's handcuffed in the backseat. Proud morning for my mother, to be sure. I'm sorry, you know, I made amends for that later on, but I promised my wife I would get sober quicker tonight. She says, you have a lot of good stuff that's happened to you in recovery. Why don't you tell some people about that, you know? But I didn't have any luck. I was drinking with the desperation. I didn't have a drink every day after my pint of slow gin, but I would have if I could have. You know, but I'm just not having any luck. I'm not drinking successfully. I'm not one of those people that had a lot of fun. You know, I imagine there were fun days out there. I just can't call them to mind. I can recall many, many, many bad days, you know. I remember drinking at the south side of Seal Beach Pier about 9 o'clock in the morning with my buddy Mike. We're drinking Red Mountain by the gallon. I think it was like a nickel a gallon back then. It was damn near free, you know. So we're drinking Red Mountain. He left me there about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I passed out. Yeah. I passed out for till about 2:30 in the afternoon, and some good Samaritan came by, thank God, and shook me to roll me over and cook me on the other side because I was burnt to a crisp. I had fallen asleep like this and didn't move. I'd burnt on half of my face, back of my neck, bottoms of my feet, you know. I've told my sponsor, and on the inside of my mouth. You know, Johns Hopkins has a series of 20 questions, right? If you're new, don't take that test. You're not here by accident. You will fail that. It's a trick. It's a trick pamphlet. Do not take. They say, if some guy walks in, take these 20 questions. Run. Run. You're going to fail. But I told my sponsor, I said, I think I should call Johns Hopkins and improve on that 20 questions. I've got a couple of new ones. I think question number 21 should be, if you've ever had a sunburn on the inside of your mouth, you might be alcoholic, you know. And my personal favorite is, if you slide alcohol across the bar or across the counter at the liquor store and you feel better before you ever make contact with the alcohol, you're an alcoholic. I did. I felt better when I panhandled $4.27 for a pint of Hiram Walker 10 High whiskey. Help was on the way, you know. Unlike drugs, alcohol always did his job. They bonded that stuff for that reason. They bonded alcohol and proofed it for us. The normie doesn't care that it's 80 proof. He doesn't really care. He just knows that it's whiskey. I care. I care a lot, you know. And alcohol always did its end of the bargain. So I'm, maybe if I do this. Okay, I'm going to stop one. Oh, man, I'm getting sober. So I drank and I drank and I drank and I didn't have any luck and, I went to service and it was bad, and I went to service and I was a hideous soldier. I've got a daughter that's in the service. I got a son-in-law that's a chief. My son was in for 10 years. My other daughter was in for 10 years. Did a great job. Not my story. I went to service. They gave me a leave. I went AWOL. They put me in a stockade. They let me out. I went AWOL. You know. And then a bunch of stuff happened. I was in the stockade during a riot and. I got my head broke and my ribs broke and I was handcuffed to the bed and I'm an escape risk and I still tried to escape. But I wasn't an escape risk. I wasn't a criminal. I was just terrified. So I got out of the service and I developed a bad habit. I got drunk and I got married and I got drunk and I got married and I got drunk and I got married. And I didn't do it with the benefit of the divorce because that's just so unnecessary. You know, you don't tell them. You know, I never told wife number two about wife number one. She's a bitch, you know, right? It's her fault. Why would I bring her up in a conversation anyway? I don't like her anymore. And then wife number three, never tell them about wife number two or wife number one. So I came back to Los Angeles. I disappeared for 6.5 years because I was so ashamed of my behavior. You know, I was tired of living on the roof of a school and in a treehouse. You know, that's just how I live. And they brought me back. My sisters found out where I was after 6.5 years, and they flew me back, and ex-wife number three was more than happy to get rid of me. And they flew me back, and I remember sitting in the living room at my sister's house, and she'd done pretty well. Her husband worked for NBC and had a nice little house, and she had a little party for me, and I was an aspiring musician. You know, and I'm, one minute I'm singing Gordon Lightfoot, and the next thing I know, I'm waking up in the morning, and I'm stuck to the shag carpet with puke. You know, and I know that I've embarrassed my sister. You know, I was just going to play some music for him and entertain her friends. And I went in the kitchen, and I looked out the window. I had to get that camel out of my mouth. You know what I'm talking about. It just, Jesus, I was so sick that morning. And my brother-in-law was sweeping his pool, and he left his wallet on the counter. And I opened it up, and I took out $5. And I don't know if that's all he had, but I remember clearly that I took $5. And it was the first time I ever went, something wrong with the way you're living. It chills when I tell that story. First time I noticed. So I quit drinking 2 years later, you know. But it was not good, you know. You know. But it became apparent to me that there was a problem, and there might be a connection to alcohol. And the truth is, as I stand here today, yeah, I've got a problem with alcohol when I'm using it, right? But when you take alcohol away from me, that's where my problem starts. My problem starts where the bottle ends, you know. So I'm not having any luck. Like I said, I'm living in a treehouse, and I'm just thinking about getting sober, and I'm living in a treehouse, and I'm drinking Red Mountain again. It's not going good, and I'm very hip now. I've got long hair, and I'm smoking weed out of a Hagen-Hake 5-star pinch scotch bottle that I made a water pipe out of, you know, and I'm just about out. Scott Redmond, bless his soul, used to talk about general anesthetic. He talked about they give you the general anesthetic, tell you to count back from 100, 199, boom, you're out. I love 99.5. If I could live there, you'd have a different speaker. You know, I love almost out. And I was out about 99.8 that night on the Red Mountain smoking weed. And my buddy came up. And thank God he came up because I was on fire. And I don't mean I was listening to Jimi Hendrix on fire. I mean I had leaned into a candle and I was on fire, you know. And so I got evicted from the treehouse. That's hard to do, you know. Hey, treehouse sounds like fun if you're 10. It's not fun if you're 30, you know. So, actually 31. So on June 25th of 1982, I got sober for the very first time. My mother was 6 years sober in AA, and I walked up to her door, and I was wearing a pair of blue Dickies, tennis shoes that didn't match. I thought that was cool. I hadn't worn underwear in a long time. I had my T-shirt. I'm not wearing any tonight. Just kidding. I figured she got so excited, I'd just give her another little shirt. Just kidding. I'm walking up, and I got a T-shirt on inside out because it's dirty. I got another T-shirt in a bag, and I knock on the door, and I said, Mom, can I come in? She said, nope, you can't come in. I said, Mom, I don't want to drink anymore. So she let me in, and she let me sleep on her couch, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did what they suggested. I stacked chairs, and I washed coffee cups and ashtrays, and we were talking about smoking in meetings. They used to smoke in meetings, but they were considered the non-smoker. They would make this section the non-smoking section. Of course, the room would be full of smoke, you know, but they did have a non-smoking section, you know. I'll tell you one more thing. When I was in Oklahoma, the chair, the voice of this conference was a guy, swear to God, his name was Jimmy Dane from Dallas, Texas. And he was hilarious. One of the things he says, smoking at this facility, says, if you don't see a butt can, you can't smoke there. No butts about it. He said, and that includes your sobriety bongs. I thought, the vapes, man, they hit that thing like there's no tomorrow. I've seen people take such a big hit. When they let that stuff out, they completely disappear in a cloud of, you know. You're smoking that for effect, man. Don't kid yourself. I would, you know. Anyway, so I did what they suggested around here, you know. I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor, and I just got a sponsor to shut you up. I didn't get a sponsor because I thought it was a good idea. You'd ask me, Mickey, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no, not yet. I'm looking for the right guy, maybe somebody in a long, flowing road with a stigmata or something, you know. And they'd say, if you don't have a sponsor, there's an idiot running your life. And I'd say, I knew, that's me, you know. Don't call me names. And so I got a sponsor for the wrong reason. He started to drag me through the steps. And things started to get better. 5.5 years, I was the general manager of this restaurant that I'd worked at 7 times. Yeah, I would just I didn't mean to leave, but I just left and I would drink, and then things would just go south. And one time they sent me to smoke on a Sunday afternoon about 1 o'clock. I came back 2.5 years later. You know, couldn't find my cigarettes. But 5.5 years... I'd gone from line cook to lead cook to sous chef to chef to executive chef to manager to general manager. Not because I have any talent, because my sponsor taught me to go to work. He said, go to work. I said, I can get a job, Lloyd. I just can't keep one. He said, go to work. I said, you're not listening. I can get a job. I just can't keep one. He said, go to work. Get there 15 minutes early. If you pull up tomorrow and that sign does not say Mickey's, you're not the boss. Just go there and do your job. If you go in tomorrow and they tell you to make blue soup, make blue soup. You know. But I brought Alcoholics Anonymous to this restaurant. You know, in the way that I treated people, and I did very well. And at 5.5 years, I started to step away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always say 10 meetings a week, 5 meetings a week, 3 meetings a week, 1 meeting a week, then a glass of wine with dinner. Right? That's how it's going to happen, you know, at least for me. But at 8.5 years, I'm nuts. I'm drier than a fire hazard. Man, I wouldn't smoke near me. I was so crazy. But I'm in the PTA. What are you doing in the PTA? I'm going to kill somebody. I'm coaching Little League. If that second baseman drops one more ball, I'm going to kill him and his family, you know. Look at my paycheck. Look how much they're not paying me, you know. Right? My wife is such a bitch, you know. When did my kids get so loud? I'm 8.5 years sober, dying of untreated alcoholism. And I went to a doctor, and he prescribed Vicodin for me. Yeah, I know. We're talking to somebody at George, right, about Vicodin. And I knew I shouldn't take them, so I didn't, you know, right away. First day, I didn't fill the prescription. Second day, I filled the prescription in case there was an emergency. On the third day, I'm driving to work, and I'm thinking really fast. You know, I got these Vicodin. I'm supposed to remember Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't really take these. I'm not going to take these. I'm going to live in a treehouse. Break one in half. Break one in half. What a great idea. How much trouble can you get in with half a Vicodin, you know? But I found a doctor that wrote a prescription for 100 Vicodin with 6 refills 7 times in 2.5 years. 4,200. Don't do the math. I've been to meetings where I didn't tell them the total, and people go, 4,200, and I don't share. And I had to wet it. You know, that's funny about pills. I didn't want people to know I was taking them, you know. I know I just took an 11-hour nap, you know, but sorry, on the front yard, sorry, you know. It was bad, and I had to wet it down immediately, and I tried to do, and I'm a drug addict also. I had slammed a little intravenous cocaine because it was too expensive to snort, and I tried to do the marijuana maintenance program. I want to tell you that does not work. If you're trying that to cure your alcoholism, it's not going to do it. You're going to eat a lot of Doritos, but it's not going to do much for alcoholism. You're surely going to drink again. And I went out there for 2.5 years, and I drove my wife absolutely out of her mind, and everybody around me had disappeared, and wanted nothing to do with me, and I'd try to drink and try not to drink and do Vicodin and try not to do Vicodin, and it was just a crazy, crazy existence. And on January 25th of 1996, I sat on the side of my bed, and my morning meditation had turned to this. I said, today's the day. Today's the day I'm going to take one credit card, my car keys, write her a note and say, I'm sorry, I just can't do it one more day. I was just going to go out there and drink the way I wanted to drink. I would go on 3-day runs and sober up by taking Vicodin. I'd go on a 5-day run and disappear. I couldn't take it anymore. I'm an alcoholic. I need to, when the beast gets hold of me and I put him at bay, he's hungry. He's hungry, you know. Anyway, so I didn't. That was my morning meditation on February 25th of 1996. This lady named Pat Smith took me to the Over 50 group. Have I got a sign yet? No. Oh, I wasn't at. No, it's okay. Yeah. He gave me the 1 minute sign. I know. Thank you. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, but on February 25th, I went to this meeting with Pat Smith, and she came back on the way back. She said, are you going to stay? And I said, no, Pat. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for me. And I could have passed a lie detector test that morning because I believed that Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work for me. You know, but I came anyway. I'm here. They say, you don't have to drink around here you don't have to drink around here even if you want to. And I'm living proof of that. I want to get loaded every day for 18 months, every single day. But my sponsor, the first sponsor I got was a lady named Tony LaRue. And you say, when I say I got a lady for a sponsor, she was the toughest person I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was meaner than a junkyard dog. But I didn't think I was going to stay, so that's why I got her. I wanted somebody to put her finger in my chest and tell me the truth, that maybe I could stay. I remember asking her to sponsor me. I said, Tony, would you sponsor me? And she said, sure, honey. And I thought, wow. I heard she was mean. She ain't that mean. She says, come here. She walks me down to the end of the sidewalk at the YMCA, and she put her finger in my chest, and she said, "Don't you ever lie to me, you son of a bitch." And I thought, wow, bad choice. I didn't realize that "sure, honey" was the last nice thing she was ever going to say to me, you know. And I had her for a couple of years, and one of the things she did that was really, really good for me is she had me read January 6th in a 24-hour day book. And what it says, "My decision not to take a drink today is the only security I'm ever going to have. My decision not to take a drink today is the only security I'm ever going to have. It's not a new car, a bigger house, another girlfriend, a new wife, smarter kids, any of that stuff. My decision..." Somebody's got dumb kids. They laughed at that. I'm just kidding. They thought I was dumb in school. I was just troubled, you know. So I got back here and I did what they suggested. And about 8 years ago now, I was diagnosed with cancer. A little bomb. Yeah, out of nowhere, I dropped that. But I was diagnosed with cancer, and it was not a good morning. You know, it's not a good morning. And the doctor says to me, he says, "Mr. Cook, you have cancer." And then he gave me some kind of a prognosis or a diagnosis after that, and all I heard was wah, 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 chemo, wah, 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 every 6 weeks, wah, wah. I couldn't hear much of what he said. So I said, "Okay, thank you, doctor," and got out of my car, and I'm sobbing now because I know it's over. I know that I'm going to die, and I called my sponsor. I said, "Tom, I'm just calling to say thank you. You know, I'm dying, and I just want you to know we had a good run." You know. So he gave me about a minute of that BS, and he said, "Are you dying today?" And I said, "No, I don't think so. Maybe." He said, "No, you're not. Call me tomorrow." Click. And I called my best friend, Glenn, I'm dying, man. I got cancer. I just got the news. It's bad, buddy. Just want you to know I've had a lot of friends. You're one of the good ones, and I just want to thank you for being that kind of friend. He said, "Are you dying today?" He said the same thing, and I said, "No." He said, "Well, if you're not dead by Friday, I'll see you at the meeting." Click, and he hangs up on me. Right? They know about that kind of thinking, right? They don't buy into it, you know. That's the kind of friends I have. But I tell my wife that morning, and my wife, prior to that, by her own admission, which she's more like Nurse Cratchit than she is like Florence Nightingale. You know, she had to take care of me for 2.5 years, so she learned how to be more compassionate. I believe God put her in that position. So I tell her that morning, she said, "It's going to be good. It's going to be okay. With Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll get through this." So I went to bed that night, and I didn't sleep well. And I woke up in the morning, and I do what I always do every single morning, 364 days a year. Every single morning, I say the third step prayer. Some days I'm sitting on the bed. Some days I'm on my knees. Some days I'm praying to God who hangs out the moon. And other days I'm just praying to the pillow. But I say the third step prayer, and I say, you know, "Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of this. Don't let this run my life. Let me look at you. Let me use belt loop sobriety. Let me put my belt loop in Larry's pants and follow him around and do what he does. Let me live like that. Don't live me. Let me live ruled by this." And I mean it when I say that. So I said the third step prayer that morning, and I shaved and I showered and I went and sat in this chair and I read this book called God Calling, and it's a meditation book. I'm not very good at meditation. I don't get quiet. I try to get it occupied with good thoughts. And that morning it said, the passage was, "Breathe my name, and as with the touch from a child's hand, your fear will abide." Breathe my name. And I know what that means. Alcoholics Anonymous says to pause when agitated and say, "Thy will be done." So I try to live, in up to that day and still today, I try to live in an existence where God is part of my life, where that power, I don't care what you call it, I know what it feels like. I can't describe it. Right? It said, "Breathe my name, and as with the touch of a child's hand, your fear will abide." You know when a little kid's afraid and you hold their hand, they're immediately less afraid. They're still afraid, but their fear has abide. And I thought about that morning, and I knew that I was going to be okay. And I said to God, I said, "God, I've got cancer. I don't know if you know that." You know, right? He knew. And I said, "And I'm terrified. I'm really afraid, God." I said, "I really need you to be here with me. And I'll do whatever you'd want me to do. I'll try to be a good soldier in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll try to be a good example of living life with unsolved problems. I promise." I said, "But God," I said, "please, God," I said, "don't let me be afraid the whole time." And that voice came to me and said, "I am holding you in my arms." And I know that to be true. Chris talked about that experience tonight. And I didn't come here for that. I didn't come here to develop that kind of a relationship. To develop the kind of relationship that when it's bad, I can just put down my backpack, backpack and walk comfortably. I didn't come here for that. I didn't come here when my solution is just all used up and I can't think of what to do next. I can figure out that maybe I just need to tap the chair and tell this new guy, sit down, I want to talk to you. I didn't come here for that. I didn't come here to be God's kid, you know. But I'm certainly God's kid. I'm the luckiest guy in town. I have a terrible, terrible head, and I know that left unattended, it wants me dead. And sad, it doesn't want me dead quick, it wants me dead slow. It wants to keeps my body alive long enough to bring my head around to torture me, right? So I'll tell you, last thing I want to say, and I'm shut up. I talked a little bit about the inventory process. I haven't got the five-minute sign yet, have I? Am I going to get it right now? 3 minutes, okay. They had me. My sponsor had me inventory my mother and my father. My mother was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She used to sponsor my wife, Nancy. And she made amends to me when she was sober for physical abuse. And she said, I'm sorry for the physical abuse. And I said, that's all right, Mom. She said, is there anything I can do to make it different? And I said to her, I'm an idiot. I shouldn't have said this. But I said, well, it was the emotional abuse, Mom. The physical wounds heal. It was the things you said to me. A couple months later, she came to me and she said, I want to make amends for my emotional abuse. And she made a genuine amends. But I only felt that much better. I had a hideous relationship. I hated my mother. I blamed her for a lot of stuff. But when she made amends to me, I only felt that much better. But my sponsor had me inventory my mother, you know, and make amends to my mother. And he had me talk about stealing $20 off the spoon rest in 1957. It's about $350 today. For being handcuffed in the back of the car. And gone for 6.5 years. For the embarrassment over and over and over again. And she'd passed, but I went to her graveside and made that amends. And I sobbed like a baby. I sobbed like a man that had contrition, a man that was sorry for his behavior. And I cleaned up my side of the street, and my relationship with my mother completely changed. If I don't get another thing out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you gave me a mother that I have a clear perception of the woman that she was. She was a terrific woman, and I love her. My father wasn't quite so lucky. My father was a chronic, chronic alcoholic. And right before he died, he got us all together, me and my brothers and sisters. He took us. He was a bookie. Sometimes he was rich, sometimes he was poor. This is a rich period. So he got us all together, and he took us to this nice restaurant, and he gave us an envelope full of money. You know, and we had the dinner, and we left. And when I was walking out of the restaurant, I looked at him in the lobby, and what I saw was a broke alcoholic man, a broken, broken alcoholic man. But I had this resentment towards him. And I got in the car with Nancy, and I'm crying, and said, I got to go back. God, I want to go back and tell him I know you better than you know you. You know, and I'm sorry for being the kind of son that I was, but I couldn't go back because I still had that resentment. My father had, Tom asked me to inventory my father. And I said, he left when I was 4 years old. What do I have to write about? But what I got in touch with is anytime you talked about your father, I did a huge character assassination of my father. And anytime that he tried to get involved with my life, because he got involved with my sister's life, I unconsciously pushed him away. I put that albumin shield between me and him. I didn't even know that I did it. But I effectively kept him out of my life because of my resentment. And my dad, I guess 15 years ago now, chronic, chronic alcoholic, drank a quart of black velvet, wrote the note apologizing for being the kind of father that I was, wrapped himself in a plastic shower curtain, laid on the linoleum floor in his kitchen, and blew his brains out. And I absolutely get that. He got a good look at his life, and he couldn't inconvenience one more person. That's why he wanted to keep it tidy. I know what he was thinking that morning. He couldn't imagine life with or without alcohol. And if you take me away from you for too long, you are my solution. Clearly, some days that scares the hell out of me, but you are my solution, right? I've heard it said, you are God with flesh. You are God with skin. More importantly, you are God with hands, and you're always there for me. You are always there for me. And with this, thanks for having me. But Howard P. always says, and I stole it from him, and I end my talk every time the same way. If you find a place where you see God pass, mark that spot and visit that window often. For me, it's right here. Thanks a lot.